Good evening. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. It's going to be April 25th when we play this. And this is the Soleri Report. I am poaching in on John Rappaport's week. He and I decided that we would talk about the story of Hamilton Securities Group. In one sense, it's very ancient history. On the other hand, it has a lot of juice in it about where the pathway is to march forward. But why don't I just start by welcoming John. And why don't you tell us, John, why you were interested in talking about the story of Hamilton Securities Group?
Sure. Great to be here, first of all, as always. I think I'm so struck by this story for several different reasons. The first one is that you were able to create something completely new by researching your own experience working inside the government and also focusing on communities and what would rejuvenate communities. And what Hamilton emerged with really was not just innovative, but I mean a new model, a new way of looking at the whole situation. So that was the first thing, the first time that we ever talked about this, that struck me as really quite incredible. And then the second, I guess, would be how that compared with your experience in similar types, you might say, I guess, of analysis within the government and where they go with their analysis as opposed to where you went with yours. I mean, it's so striking and so illustrative of exactly what we're facing in this country.
Right. It was the old model and the new, you know, I was trying to birth the new model and the old model was saying, no, no, we want to suck all the juice out of the system to keep our old model going a little bit longer. Yeah,
exactly. So, if we could begin with the transition point, that is, what you saw from the old model that gave you such pause, and then your decision to move out of that into something new.
Well, so Hamilton Securities was a company that I created when I left the Bush administration in 1990. And I had seen three things that were driving me, John. The first was and I'll say it the way I'd say it now, was that what I saw when I worked in government was that if you looked at the financial system by place, so for example, the United States just breaks down into 3,100 counties. So think of a county as a living ecosystem. So we have a environmental ecosystem and we have people. So people and places, and whether it's the animals and the plants and the other living things or the people, we've got a living ecosystem. So I said, you know, I want to map out and be able to look at the financial system within, you know, aligned with the living ecosystems, because we need our environment and our financial system to start to play win-win and to align with each other. But when I was in the administration, the first thing I saw was that government investment had what I call a negative return on investment. So imagine if you bought a mutual fund, if you in your IRA or 401k bought a mutual fund and every year it went down 10%. And every year you had to put in 10% to make it go back up. That's a negative return on investment. And in a world where you have a negative return on investment, there's never enough money. But if instead every year you put your $10 into something that goes up 10%, then there's, you know, it's the gift that keeps on giving. There's more and more money. So the first thing that I saw when I was in the government was that government money was being used to destroy neighborhoods. So we were spending a great deal of money and doing things that had negative returns as opposed to positive returns. And there were enormous political constituencies that grew up for these negative returns. So, for example, I would find neighborhoods where we were spending $250,000 per unit to build public housing, but 50,000 could rehab a foreclosed property. So you could get four or five homes for the price of one. But if you tried to change that, you'd run into all these constituencies getting furious. You know, people were very vested in this waste. So one was that the government money had a negative return on investment. The second thing I saw was that you, by using government guarantees, we created a system where, and I call it a debt-based model, where people really didn't care about the health of the whole. So once upon a time, if I'm a community bank and I'm financing mortgages in a neighborhood and the education becomes poor and crime gets going in the neighborhood, I care because it's going to lose me money. You know, the mortgages are going to default and I will lose money. But if I'm wrapping all those mortgages up and securitizing them with government guarantees, then lots of drugs can come into the neighborhood and I don't really care because I'm still making money. I'm not losing money because the mortgages have government guarantees on them. You know, and I'm still getting the servicing income or I put them into Freddie and Fannie. So you have this debt model that's unhealthy. And it seemed to me, and of course the government subsidy was helping it keep going. And then the third thing was when I was in the Bush administration, I discovered new technology. And I said, wow, you know, this technology can so improve the learning speed and the ability to collaborate within a place that there's tremendous productivity increases we can get that will help small business be very competitive globally, particularly if they'll collaborate within a place. And so those three things came together. And I said, you know, if we switch to an equity model that integrated this new technology, and we re-engineered the government investment to a positive return, there could be explosive wealth opportunities. Now, that sounds all wonderful, but the nuts and bolts of trying to prototype that is a great deal of because you're basically changing how the money in a place works. And not only that, when you change it in one county, you're changing it in all counties. So you're talking about a lot of money being re-engineered. So my notion was, well, let's start an investment bank and let's prototype. Let's take this technology and see, you know, by integrating it in our own enterprise, let's see how it changes the economics of one small business. You know, we'll be the guinea pig. And then let's see what we can do in terms of helping communities finance privately with equity. So we just started. But that was the idea because you saw these three incredible opportunities when you got deep into the government money that I saw in the Bush administration. And that was the idea of starting Hamilton. The other thing I just have to tell you, and this is true confession, I was infamous on Wall Street for sort of protecting my deals and my team from all sorts of greater politics. And then when I got to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, I ended up with, you know, I was in a funny kind of situation where I was trying to operate my operation clean, and there was tremendous political pressure to operate it dirty. And I ended up in a situation where I was called into Jack Kemp's office. He was the secretary. And he spent 20 minutes ordering me to lengthen my skirts. You know, this is sort of how you torture somebody when you can't yell at them for not breaking the law, for refusing to break the law. You torture them for these things. So I was sitting there, this guy's ordering me to lengthen my skirts, and I knew if I didn't somehow placate him, that what he would do, since I was very wealthy, was, you know, he couldn't scare me about money, but what he would do is then he would detail or fire or hurt one of the career people who worked for me, and I felt very loyal and protective. So I knew if I didn't placate him, you know, somebody would get detailed to Alaska. And so I remember saying to him, oh, Mr. Secretary, thank you for your courage and sharing me your feelings. I'm immediately going to go home and lengthen all my skirts. And the whole time I'm thinking in the back of my head, this is the last time I get myself in between a psychotic political force and 7,000 honest, hardworking people. Wow. So I think, you know, I think it's the time has come that I need to start my own company. And that's something I swore I never did.
Point number three, you mentioned starting, you know, a small small investment bank, this was the idea that you had to do something on your own, or this was an idea that you were proposing within the framework of government as a trial run?
Well, when I was in the government, I did a lot to encourage both place-based disclosure of government money and place-based optimization of the use of government resources, and ran right into a very significant political wall, which I now believe was the black budget. Because a lot of the fraud, you know, the mortgage fraud that we've seen go on, whether it was in the 80s around Iran-Contra or in the last housing bubble, couldn't go on with place-based disclosure.
Exactly does that mean, that disclosure? What does that entail if it was done right?
Okay, so if you buy a stock, every year you get an annual report that says here's the sources and uses of money in the company that you've invested in, right? Okay. Now, in fact, most Americans put a lot more money into their taxes than they do into the stocks that they buy. So if you were going to get the equivalent of SEC standard disclosure for the taxes you pay, you would get financial reports that show for the areas within which you vote for political representation. So for your congressional district, for example, you'd get an annual report and quarterly reports that says, okay, here's the sources and uses of how your resources worked within your congressional district. So here's all the money in taxes that people paid. Here's all the credit that they guaranteed or took responsibility for. And here are the other resources. And here's how they got used. And here's different metrics of performance.
So this would explain, for example, how huge amounts of money can be, quote, poured into inner cities, and yet we see things getting worse.
Right. So we've seen, what's interesting is if you look over the last 50 years, as technology has caused, you know, the price of everything from computers to autos to drop dramatically in real terms, you know, the cost of government is skyrocketing, but the performance metric is going down. So if you look at any measurement of our well-being and health, you know, many of those measurements are falling, you know, so crime's going up, fraud's going up, blah, blah, blah. And the cost of government is skyrocketing. And that's because government money is being used to centralize and finance a whole lot of things off budget, off balance sheet. You know, so we're using government money to centralize wealth and engineer the society in a variety of ways. It has nothing to do with optimizing the economy.
Hmm. So really, a lot of this money that is supposed to be going into improving life of communities is being diverted into other places. It's just not arriving at all.
Right. It's being diverted in a variety of ways. It's important to understand, John, that this sort of political allocation of resources is not just political allocation for the people at the top. Throughout society, we have many different constituencies who are easily placated by more government money. So this is not just a scheme by the people at the top. This is a serious non-accountability within a democratic structure. Because think of it, if you're a citizen and you're going to vote for political representation and you're going to hold them responsible, then you need to be able to see a sources and uses of financial resources for the world that you walk around and understand and know. Let me give you an example. When I tried very hard when I was in government to implement a series of different reforms in terms of financial transparency, one of which was place-based. And, you know, obviously it fell on dead ears. So when I started Hamilton, one of the things we did is we built software tools. We were starting to build a suite of software tools called Community Wizard that would allow you to identify all the databases in the government about sources and uses of different resources and start to map out the financial resources, the government resources for your place. And I had a partner from Wall Street who came to Hamilton in 1995 or 96, just as we were having the first prototypes of Community Wizard launched. And he came in, he was from Westchester, it's from Bronxville. And he came in and he was very depressed about the state of government, and he was sort of ranting about it's all hopeless and Washington's corrupt. And I said, well, and I started to explain my idea of bringing transparency to place-based resources and the extent to which this would help allow different constituencies to start to re-engineer and re-optimize government resources in a healthy way. And he said to me, oh, this is a completely stupid idea. And I said, well, where do you live? He said, I live in Bronxville. So we loaded up all of the consolidated account financial reporting from Bronxville and started to show it on the monitors in sort of geographic information software and other kinds of ways of mapping it and making it more easily understood. And he took a look at the first item, which was flood insurance, and he said, $4 million for flood insurance. Do you know how corrupt that is? And I said, why is that corrupt? He said, Bronxville's on a hill. I've lived there for 30 years. There's never been a flood in Bronxville. So the next day, I had a conference call with him at 10:30, and he was famous for always being on time. And I called. His number was busy. I finally got through about 1 o'clock, and I said, where have you been? We had a conference call at 10:30. He said, I've been on the phone with the deputy mayor of Bronxville for 4 hours. And he said, all this corruption is going to stop. I went through every item with him, item by item. You know, I've been through the whole thing. It's all going to change. And I said, I thought you said it was hopeless. He said, that's before I had the numbers for my neighborhood.
Wow.
Well,
yeah, that's very powerful.
Well, think about it.
I'm just thinking about where I grew up, for example, which is also in Westchester. And you know the streets, you know the people, you know some of the businesses. So now if you can overlay that with numbers and facts about where money that's coming in is actually going, as opposed to where you would think it would go or it should go, it's very riveting if you actually live there. It's a whole different thing than somebody saying, for example, well, did you know that federal monies that were earmarked for such and such a place, which you know absolutely nothing about, didn't really get there, or they were misused, or they were used in some way to make things worse. This is where you live. This is a whole different picture.
Right. So we used to get inventories both at the Resolution Trust Corporation and at FHA saying, here's where our defaulted mortgages were, and you'd go to that place and, you know, there'd be an empty lot. There were no houses there.
Wow.
Right. And one of the most controversial things we did was we started to publish geographic information system maps showing where the foreclosed mortgages were. And ooh la la, the patterns it began to show. And, you know, I used to wonder when I was in the administration, I'll never forget being taken on a tour of Chicago and discovering neighborhoods where one property had defaulted 5 times within a year. How can that be?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But these are the things that if you have small business people and municipal officials within a community who are regularly looking at those numbers and being able to lead a conversation, I'll give you a perfect example. Today in America, in 37 states, in the food stamp program, if you call up the customer service hotline and you have a customer service need or data servicing need on your food stamps, you get somebody in India working for JP Morgan Chase doing a job that you could do. And if you were doing that job, you wouldn't need food stamps. So the government is paying someone in America not to work, and then they're paying JP Morgan Chase a markup for somebody in India who's doing a job that person in America could do. That's what I get back to about the negative return on investment. You can see those places in your community where if the federal government is paying a corporate contractor $75 an hour to do something that you would love to do for $25 plus healthcare, you can see an opportunity to reoptimize and get the negative return on investment positive. So good for taxpayers, good for the local economy, you know, win, win, win. The problem is that that it removes something from corporate earnings, and that's part of holding the stock market and the financial markets up.
Right.
So this idea of centralized.
You move out of government. You move into starting your own company. So what was that transition like?
Well, we started Hamilton, and we started to build databases that would allow us to look at real estate ownership and land use by place, and compare how that related to, we were building databases of institutional capital. And as we started the business, we got hired on competitive contract to serve as financial advisor to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which was a funny situation because one of the reasons I'd started Hamilton was that the Harvard Endowment had a large real estate and property management company that had asked me to start Hamilton and serve as their investment banker. And I had agreed to do it. It was one of the reasons I decided to start the firm. And at the very last minute, we were at the Harvard Club in New York to sign the contract. At the last minute, they abrogated the deal and said, we want 20% of your equity. And I said, no. And then ended up, because we didn't do that contract, we had the capacity, and I ended up bidding and winning on the FHA lead financial advisor. And the funny thing was, by working for HUD and making their programs efficient, it meant that the Harvard company could no longer profit from the inefficiency. And so it's funny because I was intending to represent the private guys and instead got bounced to represent, you know, the government agency and subsidizer which at the end of the day cost them a great deal of money. It's kind of funny. But they spat me out, and I ended up over at FHA. Anyway, here's what happened. During the 80s, you had, same thing, a housing bubble and then a bust, same as we've had recently. We go through these cycles. And what had happened was the government had ended up with a fantastic amount of defaulted mortgages that they had put in something called the Resolution Trust Corporation and then auctioned off. And there'd been a very successful auction program. And as it was winding down, it turned out that HUD had taken in approximately $12 billion of defaulted mortgages and had just sat on them, had done nothing with them. And so the question was, what would HUD do? And it was widely considered to be very difficult to do these kinds of transactions within the HUD umbrella. It was a matrix structure, and the politics were very intense. And so we were brought in, and it turned out that of the $12 billion of mortgages, they had $8 billion, I think, that were multifamily and $4 billion that were single family. But their recovery rate on the mortgages was 35%. Let me explain what that means. Let's say you finance a $100,000 mortgage, and then it defaults. If you only get $35,000 back for your $100,000, that's a 35% recovery rate. Okay? And we were able, in the course of working for HUD, to get the recovery rate from up to 70% to 100%, depending on the program. And what you need to understand is the difference between, say, that $35,000 and $70,000 was something that a private party was getting. So, in fact, what you had was you had a series of private parties who, because HUD was operating at recovery rates way below industry standard, you know, a variety of people are making money off of this inefficiency.
Right.
So during our work for HUD, HUD estimated, the General Accounting Office estimated, that we saved them $2 billion. So that was $2 billion that was moving out of the pockets of people like the Harvard Endowment and into the taxpayers. And that's how
And
I
how does
get
HUD react into that?
well, it depends on, it depends on who. HUD was thrilled until they had to manage the political disappointment of the private constituencies. I mean, here's the reality. The federal government is not run to optimize return on investment to taxpayers. It's run to optimize return on investment to a variety of political interests and political contributors. And that's part of what we're talking about. How do we rebuild alignment so that we can get our politics and our economics in sync here? Because we're spending a fortune to so let's go back to the food stamp program. We're spending a fortune to ship jobs abroad that could be done in this country. But that makes it easier to control centrally, and it also means that the company with a stock that's publicly traded and gets those contracts, it helps support their stock. So when we allocate governmental resources, we need a clear criteria on what we're trying to do. Are we trying to pump up the stocks of the political contributors, or are we trying to get the best economic results for the taxpayers?
So what happened to Hamilton after you brought in that bonanza for HUD? How did the company move
Well,
on?
let me talk about the evolution. So the first thing that happened was we started to do loan sales. And we started off with a portfolio of $1 billion of mortgages. Remember, the recovery rate before we started was 35 cents on the dollar. And we did three things that were considered highly unusual in the world of loan sales. The first thing that we did before we did a transaction, John, it was very interesting. We said we're not going to do a loan auction. What we're going to do is we're going to write a design book on how to do a loan auction. And in fact, the first one was 2,000 pages long. And we finally hired the guy who had done the big loan auctions for the RTC and put him in a conference room and had him read all 2,000 pages. And he found six changes to the whole book. And what was interesting is my guess is that one or two of those changes, if we hadn't caught it and fixed it, would have gotten the deal stopped. So you're dealing with something very, very complicated. But what we wanted to do was bring transparency to the process. And it was thanks to the internet we were able to take this 2,000 pages and literally sort of share it collaboratively among all the people in Congress, in the administration, throughout Washington, who would be impacted by the transaction. So we got buy-in for the design of how we're going to do this. And we would put the design books up on the internet so that all the bidders and everyone could understand exactly what was going to happen and how it was going to happen. So it was a very, very transparent process. Okay, and that was at the time that was considered quite remarkable. The second thing we did was up until that date, if you wanted to bid on a loan sale, you had to do a fantastic amount of due diligence, run around and look at all the properties. And we said, we're going to save everybody that cost. So on a $1 billion auctions figure, your due diligence cost would be about $150,000. So the second thing we did was we said, okay, we hired a big eight accounting firm, and we had them run around and take pictures and put everything in a database, and then we put it up on the internet in Bloomberg. So you could literally be sitting in Hong Kong and for $50 get the whole package and lob in a bid. And it dramatically opened up who could bid on this stuff. So you didn't have to be part of a world of people who knew HUD and worked in HUD. You could just we invited in a whole different world of people. Okay? Then the third thing was we traditionally when you have a mortgage auction, you would stratify the portfolio so that let's say you know, all the loans in this county would be sold in a pool, and you bid for that pool, and then all the, you know, or all the loans that were in buildings that were pink with yellow polka dots would be in a pool, and you could bid on that pool. And generally what would happen is the financial advisor way ahead of the bid would have to say, okay, well, I think the mortgage guys are going to want this, or I think the real estate guys are going to want this, or I think the securities guys are going to want this. And you would stratify the bid to appeal to one of those markets. And I said, you know, I'm not smart enough to know which one of those markets is going to bid the best 6 weeks from now. So what we're going to do is we ended up hiring AT&T Bell Laboratories. And we said they have optimization methodology that they use to route telephone calls. We're going to have them put together, adapt their models so that everybody from all of those different markets globally can bid and self-stratify. So the mortgage guys can say, I want it stratified this way. And the real estate guys can say, I want it stratified this way. And the securities guys can say, I want it stratified this way. And they can all bid in whatever way they want. And then we put it in a giant optimization model, and the combination that produces the most for the taxpayer wins. Now, it was really funny because at the time, it dramatically shifted the pricing in the distressed mortgage market by a lot. It just completely changed the balance of power between the money managers and the people who are bidding mortgages. And in a way that was very, you know, it's very unusual for a new technology to power shift a market and the pricing in a market in a major way. And it did. And I'll never forget, I had to call the head of the Harvard Endowment Real Estate Portfolio, who was the guy who squirreled the deal. And I was calling him for another reason, and he picked up the phone, and he said, he just screamed, F you. And I said, Mike, it's so nice to talk to you. What is the matter? And he said, I hate this optimization model. I said, why do you hate it? He said, the only way I can win is to bid more than everybody else. I said, yes, isn't that wonderful? I'm doing such a great job for my client. And he said, well, I'm used to winning by being smarter. And I said, well, you know, I didn't say maybe you shouldn't have abrogated your deal, because now I'm on the other side.
Yeah.
Anyway, but what happened was the optimization model drove the prices through the roof, because it pitted the mortgage market, the securities market, and the real estate market against each other. And it was really a first time in that world that had happened. Now, what that meant was you had a lot of different players who were used to living in a secure cocoon. HUD was a very complicated place. You know, so if you were the Harvard company, you had a tremendous amount of intellectual capital that gave you a tremendous advantage. Suddenly that was being deleted because the technology could make all the information so accessible. So you could be sitting in Hong Kong and, as I said, lob in a bid. So it really fundamentally changed. It changed the process. Now, one of the things that was the auction started and the model was very successful, and for a while HUD was pretty happy because they were getting so many kudos. The program, the loan sale program, won awards. The recovery rates were improving. And that was important, John, because the recovery rates were a key variable in what's called credit scoring. So if you're HUD and you're going to issue 100 million of new mortgage insurance, a law had been instituted during the Bush administration that said, if you're going to lose money on that 100 million, you've got to post it in upfront appropriations before you can write that book of business. So the amount of money you posted was very much a function of your default rate and your recovery rate. And if you can cut your recovery rate in half, it means you have to post a lot less in appropriations. So by cleaning up the back end, you're making the front end much more efficient. Okay. And of course, one of the things that happened was when they canceled the loan sale program, they went back to doing it the 35 cents way, but they kept assuming the higher recovery rate. So our recovery rate's high now. So we're going to cancel the thing that gets us the high rate and just pretend. So.
Nightmare.
Anyways, so what happened was, as we were proceeding along the loan sales, this was in 1995, 96. One of the things we said was, you know, it's only fair that a homeowner should be able to bid on their loan. So if I'm a homeowner and I've defaulted on my loan, and I, you know, if the institutions are going to come along and bid, so let's say they're going to bid 70 cents on the dollar, it's only fair that a homeowner should be able to lob in a bid. Right?
Sure.
Right. So HUD was adamant that I could, they were adamant we could not, they could not do that. And they could never explain why. They only wanted, I think it was, they only wanted the bids to be a million or more. So, but basically they shut out, you know, the little guy. And they were adamant about it. Right. So what you're saying is that, you know, Goldman Sachs can come in and buy this mortgage for $100,000, even though the homeowner will pay $120,000. And I could never figure out why. And in fact, one of the people who was adamant in stopping it from happening, I used to always get these debates in, was a former deputy of mine. And we used to have these wars, and everything he said made no sense. And he was a terrific guy, somebody I really trusted. And it was only many years later when I realized, oh, you know, you had so much black budget fraud going on in that portfolio. There was no way they could afford for people to bid one by one.
And obviously there was also a sense of you lost. You had a house. You lost the house. You can't get back in the game because, you know, you lost. So now the winners are going to be the people who have nothing to do with the community, nothing to do with your house. They're just going to, you know, make money off of this.
Well, one of the things that was interesting is what I said was, okay, we've proven, you know, that HUD can do this. We've proven that we can get the recovery rate up. But right now what we're doing is we're running single family auctions in the Southwest and then multifamily auctions in the Southwest. What we need to do is we need to auction this stuff by place. So instead of doing single family in a region and multifamily in a region, let's take everything within, you know, this congressional district or this county or this municipality. And let's let somebody bid for everything within the place. And in fact, with the optimization technology, we can do it both ways. And the one that gets the higher price wins. And that way the local guys can get together, team up with the financial institutions and come up with something by place. We called it, in fact, we called it a Rouse Trust after Jim Rouse, who was the developer, very famous developer, started the Enterprise Foundation. And so, and I said, you know, because then you're creating a constituency for reengineering, first of all, switching to an equity model within a place and reengineering government investment so that the place is healthy. So for example, if I pick up a lot of real estate at an inexpensive price within a community, let's say I do a Rouse Trust in a community, I pick up a lot of real estate cheap. Well, then what do I want? I want the incomes to go up so the value of the real estate can go up, right? So I want the place to be successful. That's how I make money.
And right, so when you were talking about people within the community or that district getting together to put in a bid, they obviously have to have a plan. They have to have something in mind. We're going to do something with this.
Right.
We're going to build on it, or we're going to refurbish, or we're going to make it better. The community is going to become better. This isn't somebody sitting, you know, in Paris who has absolutely no interest in the community.
Right. And in fact, you could use a vehicle like that to, you know, if you look, and this was one of the reasons we wanted the transparency, if you look at all the defaulted mortgages and government assets within a, again, within a congressional district, within a county, within a municipality, there's a tremendous amount of stuff cross-agency, particularly at a time like this. So, you know, well, so let's take, you know, let's take Tulsa. So you have defaulted mortgages at FHA, you have defaulted mortgages at Fannie, you have defaulted mortgages at Freddie Mac, you have defaulted mortgages at VA. You have different agencies that has taken over different assets. You know, in fact, we had the Transit Authority funding mechanism of transportation when I was in the Bush administration had taken over a stripper joint. You know, so you just have an unbelievable amount of land and real estate and other assets within a place that have come in these variety of ways. And I'll give you an example. The first time it came to me to do the equivalent of a venture fund or a real estate investment trust for a place was when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing. And we were going through the defaulted mortgage and foreclosed property inventories, and we discovered a town in New Mexico where 70% of the mortgages in that town were in default and owed by Fannie, Freddie, and FHA. And I said to my staff, I said, look, this is really simple. Tell them to start a trust or a REIT, I don't know what the right structure is, and we'll swap them debt for equity. And they looked at me like I was nuts. They said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, just have the town buy the mortgages. And they said, but the town doesn't have any money. I said, I'm from Wall Street. You know, we never had any money. We used other people's money. So just, you know, just have them create a trust structure and create a class of equity, and we'll just swap the mortgages for equity. Because, you know, you can't get these people to pay off the mortgages by screaming and yelling at, you know, they have to reinvent their economy. And that means they need to get in an equity model and not a debt model. And so, you know, my staff looked at me like I was absolutely nuts. And that was the first time I thought about, okay, how do we get a community in a venture model or an equity model where we can start to build very powerful collaboration and alignment between the people within that place and the investors who are investing in that place, and have them all want for the place to succeed instead of making money on it fail and sticking the tab to the federal government.
So I'm assuming then that as Hamilton developed, that this became, you know, a wider strategy, you know, to get within the community to develop equity models and to thereby save their communities.
Well, I'm, you know, one of the goals of Hamilton was to prototype, because we weren't sure where the opportunity was. We just intuitively knew it was there. So we started to take steps as we made money on our investment banking business, both the working for HUD and some of the other things we were doing. As we generated profits, those profits were reinvested in prototyping community venture funds. The first thing we did was, in fact, not the venture funds. Issue number one is, how do you get the education and skills in a place to improve? Okay, so if we have people in places and we want their skills, you know, we knew the economy was globalizing and so many of the jobs are going away. So if we want people to get new skills, how do we improve education and the circulation of intellectual capital and skills within a place? So that was issue number one. And I went to, it was during welfare reform, I went to a wonderful conference. It was then called the Playing to Win Network, that it put together by a wonderful woman named Toni Stone from Boston. And it was of computer learning centers. And I went up to her and she was talking about the cost of a computer learning center. And once you got a computer learning center in a poor neighborhood, how much it could accomplish. So I said to her, look, if Section 8 housing could fund the space and the equipment, could that kickstart a dramatic increase in computer learning centers? And she said, oh, it would be incredible. So one thing led to another, and I spent a significant amount of time and money helping HUD invent a program called Neighborhood Networks that would allow communities, or would allow anybody who had HUD-subsidized funding, to use that funding to create computer learning centers. Because with welfare going away, people needed to learn the skills to, you know, get a job. And so the idea was, you know, just like when most people lose their jobs, they, you know, they start a home business, or, you know, they sit down and they learn a new skill and off they go. The idea was to facilitate the transition. So the first thing that happened was we worked with HUD to develop the Neighborhood Networks program. And what happened was amazing, because at the time, John, you had a lot of people saying, look, I'll never forget, I had one of the people in the very high up in the Clinton administration say to me, look, you know, black people are hopeless. So those populations are just going to have to die off, and we'll bring in immigrants, and they'll revitalize these communities. And I said, well, you know, I just don't feel that way. I just don't feel people are hopeless. And what was interesting is all these computer learning centers went in, and there were many predictions. Oh, everybody's just going to play basketball. Nobody's going to go in the computer learning center. And it was quite the opposite. You had a phenomenal experience of people pouring into the computer learning centers, learning all sorts of new skills, and just knocking people's socks off with what could be accomplished in terms of building, you know, building skills and being able to get jobs. And it quite, you know, it was a phenomena that really turned the picture around in a lot of people's mind about the potential of people in poor communities, particularly minority communities. So the first thing we did was Neighborhood Networks. The second thing that happened was we needed, as a company, phenomenal amounts of data servicing. And one of our questions was, how do we get this data servicing? We clearly needed to outsource it. And I, in fact, at one point I went to China to try and figure out if we could outsource it to China, and finally concluded that it was cheaper and more efficient to outsource it into the United States. And I was at a conference with the head of the Chicago Public Housing Authority. And I asked him what was new in Chicago, and he said, oh, you know, we're busing the mothers at Cabrini Green out into the suburbs to do office jobs. And I said, well, that's crazy. Why don't you put a satellite dish on the top of Cabrini Green and bus the jobs into Cabrini Green? You know, why bus the people out to the suburbs? And a light bulb went off in my head, and I said, okay, you know, maybe that's how we get all the data servicing we need. So we found a property in Washington. We agreed with, in fact, it was a Hollywood entertainment company who was very interested in job training and using Hollywood skills for education. And we started a computer learning center in a low-income community in Washington. And what we said, we had a data servicing course, and what we said to everybody in the data servicing course, if you pass this course, you will get a job for a year in a company that's going to be started. And if the company does a good job on the data servicing, you get to keep the contract. And so thus came about Edgewood Technology Center, which was a prototype we did for a data servicing. And one of the things we discovered, it was during welfare reform, the federal government estimated that they needed $6 billion plus in data servicing just from the passage of welfare reform. And my attitude was, well, if you can't send welfare into those communities, send the data servicing. You know, you got $6 billion of work. So, you know, and those are jobs that can be shipped anywhere in the world. And, you know, I suspect if you look at the government contracting, we're shipping those jobs all around the world. I remember during the bailout saying that Citibank was shipping their data servicing over to Korea, where people who do not speak English was doing it. So, you know, those are jobs that can be shipped into any neighborhood in the country. And anyway, so that was our prototype, and it was very, very informative in terms of showing us what the opportunity was. Now, one of the political problems was as they were doing the data servicing on government money by place, the people who were doing the data servicing were learning fantastic amounts about how the money worked in their neighborhoods. So if you're trying to centralize control, it was not necessarily a prototype that you would have loved.
Right. So did this program of data servicing continue to expand, or was there a point in Hamilton's history where it all started to go south and people said, we don't want this to happen?
Well, what was happening was that the different things we were working on were all, in one sense, going very well. So the loan sales were going very well. The data servicing, the neighborhood networks was going very well. The data servicing was going slower, but it was, you know, there was clearly a very good business there. And then we added, and then we started to work on the software tools that would facilitate developing places in this way. So we started to make the software tool called Community Wizard. We started to make a software tool called Community Offering in a Box. So as a small business, people in a place wanted to get together and do a venture fund. You know, it was a software you could write a prospectus by clicking the radio dots and going through the whole process of, you know, how you raise capital. And, you know, we had a suite of about 10 or 20 tools like that that were quite remarkable. We had one tool that was funny. For Fortune 1000 stocks, if you were a portfolio manager, you could put in the ticker symbols of up to 1,000 Fortune 500 or Fortune 1000 stocks, and it would print out a map of where your employees were so that you could see the companies that you were investing in and what places had an impact on their well-being. So, for example, if you're, you know, if there's a hurricane in Katrina, you could see, well, what companies are affected. Anyway, so we're making those software tools. And then the last thing was, and the important thing to pull it together, was we started to prototype venture funds for a place. So the idea was the small businesses in a place who want to participate get together and issue stock in a pool that can help finance the businesses who participate within the place. So imagine you're walking down the street in Carlsbad, and imagine, you know, there's a little logo over the businesses that are participating in the pool. And imagine if you own stock in the pool that, you know, if you shop at those stores, it's going to generate earnings for the companies in the pool, and it'll make your stock go up.
Yeah, I'm imagining it right now.
Well, the idea being, you know, because technology should help the little guy. So if you're, imagine you're 100 businesses in a place, and there are things you can share. You can share accounting, you can share lobbying, you can share tax expertise. More importantly, you want talent. You want to be able to start an apprentice program and attract young people who can circulate among the businesses, and you can build a deep management bench. There's all sorts of things you can do if you can aggregate and access capital. But more importantly, if you can have a venture pool, so essentially what you could do was you could create a vehicle for small businesses to access equity capital. We were at a time in the beginning of the Bush administration, when I was at FHA. What happened was, after the pump and dump of the housing market, you had the housing bust. Small guys who were dependent on bank credit got shut out from credit, and the only people who could access capital were the large companies. And so the stock market rose, and they could access lots of capital. And what happened as a result was you had the big companies take up a much bigger market share locally than, you know, away from the small business. So the small guys lost access to capital, and the big guys had a field day, okay? So part of my interest was, let's create vehicles for small business to raise capital in a way that makes them competitive. So let me give you an example. 50 years ago, if we'd gone into any neighborhood in America, we would find lots of small businesses and being very successful. And let's say you had 100 businesses and they're generating $100 million a year in sales. And let's just say you had $10 million of profits. What happens is those companies are financed privately by families, And then as the big corporations are financed in the stock market and have PEs of, say, 10 and 20 times, but a small company only has a price-earnings ratio of about 5. So that $10 million of profits, which is worth $50 million, you know, in the hands of small families, if the big companies come in and take it over, they can turn it into $100 million to $200 million. And so there's enormous political pressure on politicians to do things that encourage the big companies to take it over, because then the big companies can afford to spend lots of money on political contributions. And in fact, that's one of the biggest sources of political contributions, is coming from the capital gains on both real estate and stocks. So we've had this process of centralization where the little guy's been outcompeted. And so when I looked at that, I said, well, wait a minute. How do we make it possible for the small guys to improve their price-earnings ratio and create liquid equity? And part of it was doing it in a model where I call it the Solari stock model, where the control shares and the money shares were separate. So we've talked about this on the Solari report before. If you go back into the archive and listen to the story of Comfort Calls, I talk about a model. A lot of times, John, where there control issues in a company. So in a media company, you know, so the Washington Post or the New York Times, the control shares are separate from the money shares. And that's so that the investors have limited ability, is the idea, to influence editorial policy. So you want strategic control to be separate from the economic participation. So this is a perfect example within a place where creating entities, and again, it was a venture fund idea, where you pick sort of 12 leaders from the community, from diverse areas of the community, and you give them the A-share control. And then you have economic interests that you can sell widely in the community or to institutions outside the community. And so literally you can sell the B shares to the state and local pension funds, and you can sell B shares to corporate partners who you want to bring in and use for a variety of, you know, specialized things, but it doesn't threaten the local control. So you have a nice balance between strategic governance and economic optimization, because everybody makes their money together on the non-voting shares. Anyway, if you want to know more about the model, it's, again, we did the Solari report called The Comfort Call Story, and we go into it in great depth. But and I will tell you, the reason I'm alive today was because of the A-share-B-share model. I had structured Hamilton. I controlled the majority of the A-shares. And so... try as they might to, you know, to compromise the governance, they couldn't. And it's a, you know, this is exactly, when you go to China, that's exactly how the Chinese do it. You know, the evil foreigners are not allowed to get the control shares.
Right. So at this point in the history of Hamilton and everything you've described so far, how are things looking for the company?
So things, on one hand, things were looking great for the company. On another hand, we ran into real political problems. And here's what it was. A variety of interests, and we all understand who, wanted to have a housing bubble. And the reality is you can't have a housing bubble, let alone with a lot of mortgage fraud, if you're running the federal credit programs honestly. So if FHA and Fannie Mae and Ginnie Mae and Freddie Mac and VA are all being run honestly, you know, you can't have a housing bubble, let alone one with a lot of fraud. So once the assumptions on recovery rates and default rates got cleaned up, the reality is if you're going to have a housing bubble, you had to get the honest people out. That was issue number one. Issue number two is, if you look at what was happening over at the Department of Justice with private prisons and the war on drugs, part of what was happening with the housing bubble was tremendous gentrification in low-income communities. And frankly, a lot of people were just being rounded up and moved into private prisons on the pretext of the war on drugs. So Whereas we had a model that says, let's start data servicing businesses in low-income communities and help people build skills and get education. You know, the other model was saying, let's go round people up and stuff them in prison. And the fundamental issue was, right, as globalization moves income and jobs abroad, are we going to retrain and retool populations, or are we simply going to, you know, delete them in a variety of ways?
Okay, so this loomed up on the horizon. I mean, you could see this as being the perhaps a major challenge. I mean, from the picture that, and this, I mean, I've never understood it at this depth before. You and I have talked about Hamilton before, but I've never gotten into it in this detail, which really gives me a vision, a real vision of what you were doing. And as this is expanding with the company and the projects and so on, you had to see looming up on the horizon that there was going to be a big challenge to this, right? I mean, you could see the clouds forming.
Well, I made a strategic call, and that was that I believe the leadership really wanted to see the United States succeed. I didn't believe that they were committed to the United States failing, or I should say the American people failing. And I'll never forget, we had a wonderful group of pension fund leaders who were on an advisory board of one of our subsidiaries. We had, on one hand, we had Hamilton, who was sort of getting in the trenches and prototyping what the economics were. And then we had created Solari to be the money manager once we figured it out and could figure out a way that the, you know, our dream was to figure out a way the pension funds could make a fortune on re-engineering America, the hope being that the pension funds needed to be able to build significant wealth if they were going to support the next couple of generations in their retirement. So that was our sort of dream come true. And we had a wonderful group of pension fund leaders on the advisory board of this subsidiary. And I'll never forget going and making a presentation to them in the spring of 1997 and showing the negative return on investment on all federal investments in the Philadelphia area, and then showing them the fantastic wealth that could happen if we finance communities with equity and re-engineered the government investment at the same time, and how much money that could make for the pension funds. And I'll never forget, there was a great guy from one of the corporate pension funds in Connecticut. He said, "This is really great. We can save the country and make lots of money." And there was a wonderful guy who at the time was president of CalPERS, and said, he looked at me, and he had worked for Saul Alinsky as a young man, and he said, "You know, I don't understand." He said, "This is Saul's model, and you know, but they were able to stop him." And I said, "Yeah, but you couldn't get the learning metabolism up fast enough, high enough, without the technology." Now, it turns out he was right, I was wrong. But I really believe the top guys wanted this to succeed, or wanted something like it to succeed. So he looked at me and he froze, and there were literally tears in his eyes, and he said, "You don't understand, it's too late. They've given up on the country. They've decided to move all the money out in the fall." And that was fall of 1997, which is the beginning of fiscal 1998, when $4 trillion started to go missing from the government, including about $159 billion-plus going missing from HUD. What he was alluding to was the frustration when Congress failed and the administration failed to reach a financially responsible budget package in 1995, and we ended up, having to shut the government down. What he was referencing was the nature, the frustration, and the feeling of the leadership that it was impossible to come up with a financially, you know, financial responsibility is never popular in a democracy because people have to hear no and they don't want to. They vote for people who say yes. So I remember thinking, you know, that this was possible, and the president of CalPERS said to me, he said, "You've got to get to Nick," referring to Nick Brady, who had been the chairman of my old firm and then the secretary of the treasury, "and tell him that it's absolutely not hopeless." Now, I just can't imagine anybody would think it was hopeless. But part of it is if you go back down to the county level, you have a tremendous amount of money being pulled out by a variety of corporate and black budget interests in ways that are fundamentally non-economic. And that's what we're grappling with when we look at reengineering the federal budget, because we've let this thing get worse and worse and worse by borrowing more and more money, and now we can't keep doing it. And so we're going to have to change. And it's not just, you know, everybody in America is going to change. How do you tell the black budget guys you can't keep stealing more money? And we can't keep, you know, propping up J.P. Morgan Chase's stock by doing things which are uneconomic. We need to prop their stock up by doing things which are fundamentally economic.
So at what point would you say was the peak of Hamilton success, after which, as I said, the clouds began to form on the horizon?
Well, I would say the clouds began to form in the fall of 1995. And we started, what happened was, and it was really, I associate it with when the private prison stuff started to really get pushed. You know, it was as though somebody had made a decision, John, to pull as much capital out of the country as fast as possible. And I think, you know, if you look at the timing, it was also the implementation of the Uruguay round of GATT. So you had the Uruguay round adapted and the creation of the World Trade Organization. And at that point, somebody had blown a whistle, and the political and economic incentives to pull as much capital out of the country as fast as possible had been created. And at that point, it was as though the world had gone mad. I mean, I had people that I'd done business with my whole life behave and act in ways that I would have said was inconceivable that they would ever have done it. But there was so much profit to be made by outsourcing and switching everything abroad. And, you know, it was almost as though people had lost their minds, whether it was sucking up the capital and moving it offshore, or engaging in the mortgage fraud, or engaging in the gentrification. I mean, to give you an example, I had FHA was doing a strategic plan. It was in 95, at the same time that FHA was coming out with affordable housing targets for Freddie, Fannie, and the GSEs. And FHA had traditionally issued all the mortgage credit in the minority communities, and then Fannie Freddie had sort of was much more the burbs and upscale. And FHA had come out with a strategic plan showing them significantly increasing volumes in poor neighborhoods. And then Fannie and Freddie came out under their jurisdiction and regulation with targets that showed them radically increasing the mortgage flow in those neighborhoods as well. And if you added up the math, it didn't make any sense. And I remember turning to one of the lead people at FHA and saying, look, you know, people are going to have to refinance their mortgage 2 and 3 times a year from prison for these numbers to work. And they looked at me and they said, shut up, this is none of your business. So you're talking about government officials engineering the nuts and bolts of what it takes to have a huge amount of mortgage fraud. So what happened was, what I was watching, whether it was, you know, that kind of mortgage fraud and predatory lending, or, you know, I think the hardest thing for me to deal with was the private prison companies, because what we were doing was we were dropping SWAT teams in communities, rounding up innocent kids, turning off the appropriations for the public defender's office, stuffing them into a prison in a way that made money, you know, on people's stocks. It was a stock market play. And there was nothing we were doing that was any different than what Hitler was doing with slave labor camps. You know, it was just hidden behind a whole lot of fancy engineering. And I think the hardest thing for me was whether it was the housing bubble or the, you know, the gentrification, the private prisons, we were doing things that created lots of cash flow in the short run, but would slowly drain the equity, the financial equity and the wealth from the broad middle class. And I couldn't understand why literally almost everybody I know was happy to go along with it. And I found myself, whether it was with various people in the housing and real estate business in Washington or institutional investors, I found myself increasingly having conversations about, if you do something that hurts the whole to make money, ultimately that has to go, you know, that has to fail. We're building a model where we're making money on destroying things as opposed to building them up. How can that possibly work?
And what was the reply that you got?
The reply that I got was 1,000 different variations of, oh, well, this is the way it's going to go.
Okay. So you had little people, relatively speaking, in the, you know, going along with bigger people, going along with bigger people, and so on and so forth. The usual model, which is the sort of stratification of motives in what can only be called a conspiracy, because that's what it is, to take money out of the country and to destroy the country. And the people who go along with it, at, you know, the barnacles who attach themselves to this kind of a program, they see something good for themselves in it, and that's as far as they want to look.
Well, but let me talk about, you know, because this story is not so much one about good guys and bad guys. Let me talk about the bad things in the loan sale program, because there were problems too. One of the things that happened from very early on is that the big securities firms were doing the lion's share of the winning, and they were bidding John significantly more amounts of money than others. And the firm that won the most during the bids was Goldman Sachs. And I could never figure out how it was that they were so successful. And then after the loan sale program got shut down, I went back and studied a lot about Promise Software and how these different firms team up with different intelligence agencies to basically, you know, even hack into banking systems. And to this day, I have profound questions about how it was that Goldman Sachs won so much and whether or not they were bidding on behalf of the government and the Exchange Stabilization Fund. Because many of those mortgages had files and had been part of, you know, part of things going on that I think were probably corrupt. And so, you know, I almost wonder if they weren't bidding to get hold of the files and kill the criminal liabilities. We've talked, in fact, about how some of the files got blown up in Oklahoma City. So you and I have talked about that before. So to this day, you know, to this day, I wonder how it was. You know, I wonder if some section of the government wasn't teamed up with Goldman Sachs and compromising the banking system to get a hold of the information they needed to make sure that they won those bids, or bidding with, you know, money from the Exchange Stabilization Fund so they could afford to bid more, or they were laundering money back in from Russia. You know, so one of the questions was, were the winning bidders, you know, part of the black budget game? And to this day, I don't know the answer to that. But I, you know, I have a lot of questions.
One of the questions that I have is, obviously, we're talking here about a juggernaut of tremendous power making the decision to move money out of the country and to destroy in the process. So why did they come after Hamilton at all? In other words, they must have felt, we're succeeding beyond our wildest dreams. Nobody can stop us. We're invincible, et cetera, et cetera. And here's a player that understands to some degree what's going on, but certainly they have no ability to harm us. But yet, at some point, Hamilton, you know, as you'll relate here, came under severe and heavy attack. Why was that?
Well, the first thing they did was they, you know, we were falsely accused of all sorts of things. So, you know, there was kind of like an allegation du jour. So if you have to go through, you know, you and I would be here for a week if we had to go through all the allegations. But So they attacked us in sort of this immersive, we had 18 audits and investigations, and it was a fishing expedition. They were never able to come up with anything. The only thing they used was a mistake that we had made that we had reported, or a subcontractor had made that we had reported a year before this all started. And so there's kind of a fishing expedition and all sorts of allegations smeared in the smear. There was a smear campaign but I think basically what they were trying to do was get rid of the honest people and do it in a way that would scare every honest person in Washington to death, because if they're going after somebody that clean, what could they do to me or you? And so yeah, you make an example and it puts a chill throughout the federal credit programs, and then you're free to do whatever you want. So I think part of it was just getting rid of the honest people. The second thing is, at one point they seized all of our databases, and it was clear they wanted control of all the software tools and databases. And it took me 6 years to get them out of court control, and when I finally got them, the most valuable pieces were gone completely. I could never get them back. So, what was very interesting at one point when they seized all the digital sort of infrastructure, right after everything got backed up, one of the government people came into our offices, and we had gone in that night when we got control back and taken the most valuable server and put it over at our law firm. And this government inspector said, "Where's the server?" And we said, "We took it last night." And he said, "You can't take it. You can't have it." We said, "What do you mean we can't have it? It's our server. It's private property." He said, "I'm under instructions. I'm under orders. Under no circumstances are you allowed to have a copy of the digital infrastructure." And I think it was because the when you took out the databases of all the mortgage defaults and mortgage originations, all the federal data that we had, what it showed was that there was fantastic amount of mortgage fraud. Let me give you an example. And I think, at the heart of this, that was the problem, was the mortgage markets could never afford to see and hear the extent of the mortgage fraud. In 1994, I was sitting in Hamilton, and one of my staff said, "There's a mortgage broker from New York that I used to deal with. They worked over in the Senate, and he wants to meet with you. And please, please, please," they kept pushing me. Finally, I met with him. And the guy comes in with this huge pile of paper, and he says, "My family for three generations has had a mortgage broker up on Long Island, and our core competency is we track all FHA mortgages in the country." I guess it was 95. And he said, "There's a terrible mistake. HUD has just issued financial statements. I've been part in the Bush administration of requiring, getting laws passed that required federal agencies to produce audited financial statements." And he said, and HUD had issued statements that they couldn't get audited, but they'd done their best. And he said, "There's a terrible, terrible mistake in these financial statements. It says the outstanding mortgage insurance in force is about $400 billion." He said, "You don't understand. It's several multiples of that." Now, John, I thought the guy was nuts. I thought he was certifiably nuts. He said, "Look, I brought you a copy of my database." I said, No, that's okay. You keep it." And, he was saying that the outstanding FHA insurance was like $1.2 trillion plus, and that there was literally, almost $1 trillion fraud that was not on, they'd issued mortgages that were not on the books. Now, having lived through what I've learned since, I think he was telling the truth and that the financials were fraudulent. But I think our databases mapping the mortgages, both the originations and the outstanding and the defaults by place, and comparing them to what was being publicly traded in the stock and the bond and derivative markets, I think that illumination would have illuminated so much collateral fraud, it would have absolutely trashed the markets. So let me fast forward. In 2008, in August of 2008, Fannie and Freddie were shut down. They were basically taken over by the government and their shareholders wiped out. Now, at the time, you had a very famous money manager in San Francisco lose $1 billion. In March of 2008, they had invested $1 billion of their investors' money in Fannie Mae stock. And then, literally 5 months later, Fannie Mae goes under. They take a $1 billion write-down, and they put a letter up on their website saying, you know, we did extensive due diligence. We had no idea. Now, what was interesting is I, as a former Assistant Secretary of Housing, had regularly been on the radio, at KPFA Radio in Berkeley in the San Francisco Bay Area, for years talking about the extent of the fraud, that there was trillions of dollars of collateral fraud in the mortgage market, you know, engineered through Fannie Freddie FHA. So how could these guys say they didn't know? Do you know what I mean? There was this disconnect between the extent of the fraud and the belief that somehow the system could keep it going and nobody needed to know or care. You know, it was almost as though we're up here in the overt world and this thing is going down in the covert world, but we can pretend it's not because it'll never pop its head up. And what was interesting is, in right before Fannie got taken over, I was thrown off of KPFA radio and censored. I was not allowed on.
I find that very interesting because I know something about the Pacifica Network because I used to do a segment on a show at KPFK in Los Angeles for some years. And eventually I began to feel a chill.
Right.
It had nothing to do with financial or economic information, but it was other things. And I could see that there was indeed a political agenda operating and that I was outside of that agenda or I was running into it. And the whole idea of, you know, free speech radio really was about, yeah, you can say anything you want to as long as you are within this territory here. But if you walk outside, then it's not going to work. We don't want you around, and goodbye.
Well, you had several things going on. You had Fannie and Freddie being taken over. You had San Francisco money managers taking huge write-downs. You had the San Francisco Fed, which is the most powerful on the West Coast, grappling with that situation. And you had the Bohemian Grove going on, you know, right outside of San Francisco. So that was not the time for me to be on the radio explaining, oh, well, we all knew. How could we not know? Every trucker in America knows this. What do you mean you don't know?
Let me ask you this now about Hamilton. How did you win? I mean, if they said, okay, we're going to make an example out of these people and we're going to grind them into the dust, which involves, of course, you know, plugging into the inherent corruption in the legal system. I mean, they've got so many cards at their disposal to play, and yet you emerged from the other end of the tunnel. How is that possible?
Well, you know, it was a miracle. It's the only way I can describe it, and it's a long, shaggy dog story, because these things get to be like trains, you know, and people get on and off, and they're different phases. But what happened, the first thing that happened was, you know, and I told the story up in the blog, this guy came to me and he said, you know, we tried to get you fired through the White House, which they did. HUD was ordered to fire us, and then HUD didn't do it. And he said, we tried to get you fired through the White House. That didn't work. So now the fix is in. The big boys have gotten together and you're going to prison. And so what started was a process of 18 audits and investigations, 12 different tracks of litigation, and a smear campaign and physical harassment. It's very immersive because at the same time you have 18 audits and investigations going on. You have all sorts of lawsuits flying at the same time. You've got a smear campaign. You've got you know, people following you and breaking into your house and running your car off the road. And, you know, it's that's why I say, if you've ever seen the movie Enemy of the State, I played Will Smith in real life because it's just completely immersive. And what's amazing, John, is the thing that's amazing about it is you're going along, you're rich, you're successful, you're used to being taken, you know, you're used to being a credible person. And all of a sudden, everybody in your family and all your friends think you're an axe murderer and want nothing to do with you, and you didn't do anything. It's just like the puzzle palace. And it's a very deeply unnerving process because what you discover is that what everybody thinks of you is controlled by these invisible forces. It's quite amazing. Anyway, so what happened was I started off dealing with everything in good faith and spending tremendous amounts of time and money on managing the legal process, et cetera. And then I reached a point where I discovered, you know, that the law really didn't matter and the facts didn't matter. You know, this was a fix. And, you know, the goal was to just exhaust you and exhaust your resources. And so what we decided to do, it was in early 2000, we had watched what happened with Gary Webb when Gary Webb put all the legal documents up on the internet. What we did is we spent 4.5 months, I had a team of 5 people scanning all the documents and very complex summaries and put it all up on the website and launch it on the internet. And when I tell you, what a turn.
This is in the middle of all your legal maneuvering and cases.
So we launched this website.
Let me just ask you one thing about this because I'm very interested. I was just writing something about this today. Normally, during the legal process, the attorneys tell the client, shut up, don't say anything, disappear, do not make any public statements because everything that you say can be used against you in court. And I've always thought that in certain circumstances, many in fact, that this is completely destructive and stupid because the thing that you actually want to do is to expose the truth. And from what you just said, it sounds like that's what you were doing.
It was very interesting because it was one of the things I discovered was the situation, what we were litigating was so complicated that many of the people on the other side didn't understand the basics. And the only way I could educate them was by making it public through the web. And we were able to get the allegations and the debate down to much less, you know, simply by our team educating the opposition. It was pretty funny. Well, I'll give you a perfect example. They didn't have intellectual mastery of the core information. So I'll give you an example. I was in one meeting once with a group of attorneys from the government. And what had happened was our insurance company was very dirty in the thing and at the last minute pulled the money on our attorneys. They dropped and they stuffed new attorneys in. And this is typically done to kind of lose you a year and a half. Anyway, so we had the new attorneys and then the government attorneys. And I, you know, the whole situation was so Orwellian. I'm sitting in the meeting and they're having a debate about whether I rigged a loan sale or not. And they're talking about a loan sale while it was going on. I was in Boston for a month. But I didn't mention it because that's the facts. They weren't interested. Nobody was interested in the facts. So I sat there and listened to them talk for 2 hours about whether or not I'd break this this loan sale. And they had no basic information whatsoever about the loan sale, what had happened. You know, they had no one had bothered to stop and get the facts. So finally I let them go on for 2 hours because, you know, they're all billing by an hour and they, you know, they're making money. So at the end of 2 hours, I said, you know, could I just interrupt and point this out? At which point they said, oh, you know, and then proceeded to invent something new to kind of, but you were in a puzzle palace. Facts didn't matter. Evidence didn't matter. It had nothing, you know, it was pure politics. I'll give you another example. We, during 1998, the Department of Justice and the HUD Inspector General and the FBI, when they seized the digital infrastructure, were caught falsifying evidence. And the property manager was so outraged at their efforts to falsify evidence, he gave us an affidavit describing it. And we turned it into the courts, and the court said, oh, this is standard operating procedure, and never explained what that meant, and didn't seem to care. And so I called up a guy who used to work in the HUD Inspector General's office. I said, actually, the court had said it was SOP and then dismissed it. I said, what's SOP? He said, standard operating procedure. If you can't find any evidence of wrongdoing, then you just falsify an obstruction of justice charge. So that was SOP. And so it didn't succeed, but the court didn't think it was relevant that the government was engaging in criminal conspiracies to falsify evidence. You know, so anyway, so what happened was, we We made all the information transparent. And it took about a year, but a wonderful reporter at Insight Magazine got very interested in the story and wrote a cover article. And that article, so a great deal of their effort got shut down when we made the website transparent. But then this guy published an article, and what was amazing was the article went up on the web on Friday. WorldNet Daily picked it up on Saturday. It rocketed through the internet. And on Tuesday, the HUD Inspector General who had led this effort was fired. Okay, so transparency strike number two. You ready for the third one? I had been working with a different reporter at Insight Magazine on all the money going missing from the federal agencies, including the $59 billion that went missing from HUD, and then turned out to be, I think, $150 billion ultimately that went missing from HUD. And HUD, right after the HUD Inspector General basically got fired, HUD had come out with its newest financial statements, and they refused to say how much in undocumentable transactions they had. And I spent a great deal of time sort of reviewing and unpacking them, and then sat down with the reporter to describe sort of all the different questions they needed to ask. They've been doing a series on the missing money from government, so they were clearly working up to the next one. The kinds of questions that they were asking, somebody who had to be very familiar with the whole FHA and mortgage insurance and securities operation at HUD would have taken somebody with deep expertise in that area to put together those questions. So 3 weeks after the HUD Inspector General retires, they send in these questions to the HUD IG office on the missing money. The questions go in by email at 12:30. That afternoon, approximately 3:30, my attorneys get a fax from the HUD IG's office saying that all investigations for me have been ended.
Wow.
So that was transparency strike number three. Well, then, but here's the thing. Then the Cuomo, who's the Secretary of HUD, cuts a negotiated deal with one of the private parties who was litigating against us, gives him basically $2 million, at which point he can file the lawsuit against us, on a civil basis. And I end up with another 5 years of having to deal with that guy. Well, it was very funny because he finally...
A miracle.
Well, it's funny because we kept coming to court. We had sued the government because the government owed Hamilton its last payments. And we won in 2003 in what was really a miracle, just a very clean judge. And we were lucky. It's a much longer story, but that was the big one. So the government said, yep, government owes you money. Or the court said, government owes Hamilton money. Hamilton's in the right. So that was the big one. So then we had this sort of sleazy whistleblower who was working with HUD and the Department of Justice. Anyway, so when that trial came up, they kept trying to force me to settle on the eve of trial, and I refused. I just refused, and that's when I was poisoned several times, and the poison got started, and it got very ugly. But finally, they had to come to court, and after canceling many times on the eve of trial, they came to court. And John, it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen, because they had not a shred of evidence. They had no evidence of any wrongdoing. And my attorneys couldn't believe it, because they kept saying, there has to be something. I said, I'm telling you, this is complete. It's a complete empty suit. They never dreamed they would be forced to go to court. And they fought like cats and dogs not to go to court, because they knew, and you had the judge screaming at the attorneys, because the question was, who was going to rig this thing, and the judge didn't want to have to rig it if there was no, couldn't they at least go off and make something up? And it finally came down to one of the last days. One of the funniest moments was there were three attorneys on the other side arguing about whether something was true. And one of them said, well, you don't know that's true. And the other guy says, yeah, I do, because Fitz said so. Look, here's a document. Fitz says it's true. And then they all said, oh, well, then it must be true. And we had reached the point where I was the only one that everybody trusted. Anyway, so that happened in 2004. So the and then of course things then go to appeal. But once we'd been through the first round of litigation on the major cases, there was no point in going any further. You know, I'd made the point that it was an empty suit from the beginning. So
what I'm interested in hearing now about is the applicability of lessons learned, what you discovered in all of this incredible Kafka journey about what's happening now.
Right. So the only reason to go back and sort of revisit the story of Hamilton is you have, you know, I always say to people I'm an optimist because I understand what is causing wealth to shrink, and I understand how much wealth could be created if we simply stop the negative. And in theory, if we were to say, forget political considerations, let's manage the economy to make the economy as strong as possible and to build as much financial wealth as possible, there's tremendous opportunity, John, to do that. And we really don't have an economic problem. We have a political problem. And that's not to say that the political problem isn't severe. But let's just talk about a couple of things. So I said, imagine if we were to optimize or to switch government investment from a negative return to taxpayers to a positive. So, for example, I use the food stamp example. You know, what if we if government needs work to be done, you know, if somebody in a community will do it for $25 instead of outsourcing it to a corporate contractor for $50, you know, let's do the $25. So let's get the most efficient solution, and let's let small business compete, you know, to do that if they're more efficient than the big business. So optimizing government resources by place is one of them. You know, an example that I gave from government spending is if we're spending $250,000 per unit to build public housing, why not let that money be competitive within a county or municipality area? So if we can rehab or fix up foreclosed properties for, you know, $50,000, well, for heaven's sake, let's do four or five of those instead of constructing new public housing. So, I mean, there are thousands and thousands of these examples. But one of the reasons I believe in bringing transparency to government money by place is then you can have a very healthy conversation within that place about what is optimal. There was a wonderful process that began in Latin America during the economic hard times in the 90s called participatory budgeting, where the communities would come together and start to, you know, to look at the numbers and take responsibility to work with government officials to create budgets. When I was on Wall Street, I knew the head of the budget for New York City, and she used to just seethe every year and say, we're spending $150 million a year on litter. Imagine if people would just pick up their own litter and we could spend that money on something more important, what could be done with it? So part of this is taking a broader, you know, citizen responsibility for where our money's going and making the most of it. And the opportunities are tremendous. So one of the things that the Hamilton story told me is there's tremendous opportunity to re-engineer government spending and investment bottom up. The second thing is that we lose a tremendous amount in this country by being on a debt model. Debt throws people out of alignment, and we are suffering from way too much debt. In one sense, what we need to do is we need to do what I call a planetary debt for equity swap. And if we can get communities and we can get the economy on a much more equity-based model, there's a tremendous opportunity for collaboration and communication that we don't have now with a debt model. So that's another one. And we see the passage of the Jobs Act and the advent of crowdfunding. And that's a very positive development, I think, that can, you know, that can help us start to kickstart the equity, the shift to equity. Another thing is if there is anything that drains our economic performance, it's having the wrong people in charge. And as the corruption has grown, as the debt model has grown, as centralization has grown, you get the wrong people in leadership positions locally, or you get, you know, you may still have the right people in positions, but they are very afraid of offending. So nobody wants to have happened to their business what happened to Hamilton Securities. And we're watching in the political process, players who play dirty. So if you're working for HUD and you're being clean, you get targeted in these kinds of situations. So I think we've really seen quality leadership locally has had their hands tied. And if we could free local leadership to just perform without fear of, these kinds of dirty tricks, a lot can happen. The next thing is, another thing which has really hurt our economy is the biggest investment that you make locally in any one of these counties is you raise and educate your kids. And increasingly, those kids are going off to the Army, they're going off to Wall Street in Washington, and they're going off to, in many communities, prisons. And they're not staying on Main Street and really building up the local economy. So think about it. You pour money into building this human and intellectual capital, and then it leaves. And so another thing that could happen is if we started to do these things, we could really attract and keep the young people of America busily engaged in rebuilding the economy in a way that could be quite wonderful for everybody. And then that brings me to, my next to the last point, which is we have an explosion of new technology in this country. So you and I have been talking mostly about a world where digital technology made a huge impact, but we now have new energy and new manufacturing technology that can mean that small business can be much more competitive globally if that technology is integrated. And when you add that new technology along with an equity model and re-engineering government investment, you're talking about sort of financially a pow, 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 and just tremendous opportunity. And so, and lastly, what I have to say is I get back to this idea of aligning with the physical environment. If we're going to heal the environment, then we need to make money healing the environment. We need to make money reducing consumption. And if you start to get places on an equity model, that can happen. It's a lot easier than many people think. Because if you have, for example, a venture fund in a community and you heal the environment, what's going to happen to the value of the stock? It's going to go up, right?
Sure, absolutely.
Right. So the final piece of this is sort of realigning life with money and doing it place by place. And it's the beginning. So all those things are possible. And I think the question is, politically, how do we make it politically feasible for that to happen? Because the story of Hamilton Securities is the story of a new model that's young, it's being prototyped, and it bumps into the old model. And now that we've pulled so much capital out of the country, and the question is, okay, are we ready to prototype and work towards a new model? And the reality is, I don't see that we have a choice other than to do that.
Well, you start with individuals, families, and communities.
The way to come at this is to say, okay, I'm an individual and I live in a community, and what are the things, listening to this story, what are the things I can do to start to take advantage of the kind of opportunities that are being discussed here? So for example, where is the opportunity for me in my community as a small business person or as a municipal official? Where is my opportunity to start looking at the re-engineering opportunities in a way that builds up income and employment and small business in this place? And, every place is different, so it's very granular. But the first thing you certainly want to do is to start to bring transparency to how the government flows work around you and to identify where the opportunities are for for the young entrepreneurs and for small business to use these new technologies to, you know, to do new things.
And one of the things that I see where I am, and I've seen it in other places where I live, is that people who live in communities, not all communities certainly, but many communities, don't even know each other.
Right.
So in order, that requires a real human change, let's say, on the most basic level, to find out, where do I live? You know, where am I? And who's around me here?
Right.
And how can I find out what's going on? But the one thing, I mean, I think that's a tremendous advantage. I can drive around my neighborhood within 5 miles of here, and I can see many small businesses. They are very visible. When people go into their houses or their apartments and shut their doors, I don't know who's who or what's what. But when I see the economic life of where I live, that's quite different, because I can go into stores, I can talk to people, I can find out, you know, more about what they're doing.
Right.
They're always interested in talking if you start asking them questions. And as you say, there are so many remarkable possibilities if people can turn away from, you know, their old ideas, the old models, this is the way it works, and consider something new. That, to me, would be, you know, the big step. Yes, there is such a thing as new, and here's what it could be.
Here are two ways to start, because I think we all have to start in ways that save us time and give us energy. The first thing to do is, if you have a good local bank or credit union, bank local. Because a lot of the smartest financial talent within a county or a community is in the good local banks. And they're the ones that are really keeping the money circulating locally and supporting small business in many cases. And that puts you, banking locally puts you in the flow of those relationships and that sort of local muscle. Okay? And it's one of the steps you can do. And generally it protects you, because then you're banking at a bank that doesn't have a big speculative trading and derivatives position. So I think you are just usually much better off in those banks. You're going to get much better service because you're doing a great job for you as their bread and butter. So the first thing you can do is you can bank local. The second thing you can do is you can look at opportunities to buy and participate in the fresh food businesses locally. Because I think one of the hardest things, you know, the question is, what can be done locally that is more efficient than can be done globally? Because you always want to focus on, you know, doing that which is the most efficient. And one of the things we're finding, John, is increasingly you can't buy healthy fresh food in a corporate context. It's simply not safe. And in many cases, what you're getting is poison. And so so what we've seen around the country is the development of local food movements and local food markets that really do provide an alternative and are quite competitive compared to what you can, you know, what you can do in the corporate vehicles. So banking local and then accessing the local food movement are usually, for most people, two steps which are very, very productive.
I see that here with local food, and I know people all over the country see the same thing. You can have greater trust in what grows locally. You can get to know people who do grow it locally. And when you step into a market, you just don't know the same kinds of things.
Right.
It might be okay, it might not be okay. The bigger the market, the longer the transport, the less you know. And the same thing with money, really, what you're saying here. I mean, if you know the people who are the local bankers and credit people, you stand a much better chance of being able to find out what the community is really all about, as opposed to money that's coming from Mars, you know, or the digital printing presses of the Federal Reserve, you know.
Well, what you're trying to do is you're trying to create intimacy. And you're trying to create intimacy in connection with people who you think are excellent. So, you know, I assure you there's in every area, there's a small business that's not excellent. That is to be avoided. So we're looking for excellence and we're looking for intimacy, because intimacy is excellence and intimacy delete a lot of the kind of risks that we're running into in this environment.
And looking back on the story of Hamilton now, the way I see it is that you had a master plan for making that possible in any community in the United States, or anywhere, really.
Right. I think
to look at all of this and to say, okay, we want to make prosperity work locally, and now we're going to develop the tools so that any community can pick up these tools and make it happen locally.
Right. My passion all my life has been, I love to build wealth, but I love to build financial wealth in a way that builds up people. And I could, you know, I never had any interest in making money from things that were fraudulent or destructive. It just seemed to me to be, it's something that real men don't do that. It's like you can't get a kick from making money out of genocide. You know, there's no kick in that. It's kind of, that's a yuck fact. Making money from doing things that have a negative return. And I want to, before we close, I want to just touch on the Solari model, because that's sort of the point of the whole thing. And, I get a kick out of building real wealth. And, John, I spent my whole life looking for a way to do that and help other people to do that. And I think one of the reasons that we were able to move through and ultimately win the big part of the litigation on Hamilton was, I wasn't trying to win the litigation. I wasn't trying to, I wasn't trying to win the litigation. I wasn't trying to make money. I was trying to find a way. I was trying to find a way to live in this world, you know, where we could build wealth in a positive way. And I think, you know, my number one goal when I came out of the Bush administration is how can we create a new investment model? Because it's clear the central banking warfare model that this planet has been operating on for 500 years can't succeed if we're going to globalize and integrate new technology. So what's the model going to be? And at the heart of everything I was doing, I was trying to figure that out. And I'll never forget, in 1997, I got it. And it was the most exciting time of my life. And what I couldn't believe, you know, thereafter was that nobody was interested. But let me just describe where I came out, which was, if you, and I'm looking at this from the point of view of an institutional investor. So if I'm a big pension fund manager, or any manager of big pots of money, if you look at an investment, it has a return to the investor, right? So I buy a stock, it's got a return to the investor, but then it's got an impact on the whole ecosystem. And I call the return the total economic return that divides between the return to the network and the return to the investor. And so what I realized is that it's really pretty simple. If institutional investors will make an effort to understand what their total economic return is and use that information as a navigation tool to find and make sure they get positive returns on investors, they will avoid a whole lot of very negative and contradictory behavior. So, for example, all the guys who were financing private prison companies didn't understand that they couldn't make money on that stock without causing them to lose money on the mortgage stocks. In other words, they were financing two activities that were going to destroy each other or that were contradictory to each other. So what I realized was, you know, that if we simply adopted a technology that said, you know something, I'm not going to try and make money on things which shrink the pie. And I'm going to make an effort to understand what does make the pie get bigger and what makes it smaller. That's really two simple changes in protocols that all institutional investors can make. And if they make those two changes, it can shift extraordinary amounts of money. and hold extraordinary amounts of money to discipline where we don't have these kinds of crazy economic cycles and pump and dump that do so much damage to the environment and ultimately to the economy. And we've reached a point in our evolution as a society and our globalization as an economy where if institutional investors don't adopt these protocols, you know, they're going to lose money and the economy is never going to work. So it's a simple little change, but it's an earth, you know, it's kind of an earthquake change in the world of money, and it's a change we're going to have to make because the old model doesn't work anymore.
Well, on so that note, because as you say, it's a simple shift in one sense, but it's so profound because it takes in the human beings who are making these decisions at every level, whether from the individual all the way up to the institution, because, you know, everybody's been proposed these moral conundrums. You know, what would you do in a situation where if you do this, this is what happens, and if you do that's what happens. And they're usually played as little games, and sometimes kids do that. Smart kids, but what's really happening is that these are decisions that are made every day in life. People make these decisions. Yes, I'm going to opt for this kind of gain and advantage, and I'm not going to look at what the consequences are over here. I'm not going to think about the larger picture. I'm not going to think about what happens beyond what I do. And then if you have everybody going along with that model, you get total destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as that, right? And if you don't, the thing that's so wonderful to me about the Hamilton story, and as I said earlier, I now understand it in much greater depth than before, is that it was an actualization of the right thing to do in the most sophisticated terms. It was, okay, what would be the right thing to do vis-a-vis money? This is an investment. This is what the right thing to do would be, and this would be how to do it, and this would be how to map how to do it, and this would be how to educate everybody who can be educated on how to do it, where they are, where they live as individuals, families, and communities, and so that's what we'll do. And as you so tellingly said, you weren't really trying to win the battle so much as to do the right thing, to build prosperity and wealth while at the same time building up environments and human beings who live in the environments. And that's what's so wonderful to me about the Hamilton story. So I thank you for telling it because...
Well, I appreciate your listening. It's quite a tour through the past.
It sure is, and it will be quite a tour through the future. Not going anywhere.
Well, prosperity, just in closing, we had a little Solaris circle that I was a part of for 7 years, and it was funny, John, we sat down and we said, okay, the total wealth on planet Earth, what percentage of what could be. In other words, if we just optimize total wealth on planet Earth, how big could it be and how does that compare to what's now? And the group, we had 10 investors, the group said that the current wealth was 1 to 20% of what was possible. So can you imagine if what is possible is 100 times the current wealth, what could be? I mean, there's no, once you dig deep and you understand centralization and what it's doing, what you realize is there's no reason for poverty. There is no economic or environmental reason for poverty. It doesn't have to be. And to me, that is the, you know, the message of the Hamilton story is we have a problem, but it ain't economic. Anyway, I can't thank you enough. This was wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you, Catherine.